Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I host the program with Carrie Figder, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Zena Hitz. Zena is tutor in the Great Books program at St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. She teaches across the liberal arts, but her specialty is in ancient philosophy. In particular, she works on friendship, love, and the law in Plato and Aristotle. Her new book has just been published by Princeton University Press. Its title is Lost in Thought: The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. We live in a culture that tends to view thought with a degree of suspicion. Thinking is frequently associated with a kind of uselessness or idleness, sometimes even laziness. These suspicions can be somewhat allayed when thinking can be directly tied to some kind of purpose or tangible result. Accordingly, we tend to conceptualize thinking of the useful sort in terms of learning, and we think of learning largely as a matter of acquiring skills that are marketable. However, when overtly attached to its products and outcomes, thinking and learning can become just another mode of commerce. They thus can become constrained and indeed corrupted by worldly ambitions. The idea that learning can be a mode of escape from those ambitions or a way of rising above them, and thus a kind of liberation from the world, seems to have been lost on us. However, in the book Lost in Thought, Zena Hitz provides a vision of how learning, often by way of solitary reflection on the deepest and largest things, is a characteristically human activity, an activity that's essential for a fulfilled life. So as usual, there's a lot to talk about. And we're going to begin, as we usually do, with our guest. Hi, Zena.
Hi, Bob. Thanks so much for prompting the conversation. I'm doing very well.
Great. So, you know, the New Books in Philosophy interviews typically begin with me asking the author to provide some biographical background to the book. And it's often characterized as, oh, before we begin talking about your book, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself? But Lost in Thought, your new book, begins with a really absorbing prologue that is largely autobiographical. So we've got the biographical sort of background to the book as part of the book. So let's start there. The book is the product of and a further step in a pretty fascinating intellectual journey. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how washing dishes restored your intellectual life?
I was a childhood bookworm. My parents also are bookworms, not academics, just ordinary people, but interested in books and ideas. So I grew up with a kind natural intellectual interest, I would say. And that was really fermented in me by my undergraduate experience at St. John's, where I teach now, which values a amateur approach to learning in the sense of learning because you love it, And learning that's directed at fundamental questions about human life, the nature of morality, the nature of politics, the nature of the universe, or the natural world, whether or not there's a God, etc. So fundamental questions that I think every human being tries to get at. And also, of course, it's a great books program so that we undertake these inquiries through big, long, difficult books. So I finished St. John's. I went to grad school for classical philosophy and through some good luck ended up in very elite programs where I'm very grateful. I learned my field to a very high degree of specialization, and I got a lot from doing that. I learned a lot that way. I also, however, was inducted into the world of elite academic culture, which is extremely competitive, extremely status-driven, extremely gossipy, centered around the pronouncement of judgment. And so I also became trained in that style of living one's life, that is, competitively in terms of status, anxiously, because of course your status depends on others. It's not totally in your control.
A good Aristotelian observation, by the way.
I spent a long time with Aristotle. He comes in and he doesn't leave. Then I followed the track that I was meant to be on. I applied for teaching jobs. I started teaching philosophy at good public universities. And at first, I loved it. I loved doing research. I loved the teaching. And then something started to wear me down. Two things, I'd say. One was keeping my life centered on research, which is the practice of a research academic, which is the highest prestige tier of American academia, is research academia. And putting research first didn't really work for me. Research didn't feel meaningful or important enough. The stuff I was writing was very interesting to me, but it was for a very small audience. And its significance was not obvious. Its grand significance was not obvious. So that was one difficulty, was that I think it wasn't right for me to put research at the center. The second difficulty was I became increasingly frustrated with contemporary teaching circumstances where you normally are teaching to a relatively large classroom. That is, even a classroom of 25 or 30, which is a small classroom by contemporary standards, that's already a classroom where it's difficult to have a single conversation. And of course, if you've got 60, 70, 80, 150, and so on, the whole nature of your class has to change, and you have to think about how to get the material into digestible form for a lecture, and how to get design assignments in such a way that they can be easily evaluated so that when you're grading 60 or 70 exams or 60 or 70 papers, you can get through them without, in only, say, 40 hours rather than several weeks. So I didn't feel myself in all of that to be passing on to my students the habits of mind that I had learned myself as an undergraduate. And there was learning that happened in every classroom. Every classroom I had students who wanted to learn, who loved learning. So I don't want to be too severe. But I also think that the whole system, which is very ordinary in higher education, nothing unusual about it, except that maybe my schools were a bit better in certain ways than, you know, they got good students and there was support from the administration and so on. It wasn't the kind of teaching and learning that made sense to me to do. I was really just exchanging grades for, memorized chunks, bullet points of knowledge. So I couldn't cope with that. So I eventually quit the profession. I moved to a religious community in rural Canada. And I spent 3 years total really without doing any professional intellectual work at all. I read really good nonfiction and some really good novels, some occasional magazine article, but I didn't lead an intellectual life in any ordinary sense. It was being in that community where I was really challenged to be a human being myself, not an academic, but a human being. And also to live closely with ordinary people, people from all walks of life, and trying to connect with them forced me to think about why intellectual activity, why reading and studying really matters, not just for professionals, but for ordinary people. I was persuaded that it really does. I knew in the community many very curious people who were just dying to know things, and often were held back not so much by interest as by a sense that somehow it wasn't appropriate for an ordinary person to undertake serious learning and studying. So anyway, that all haunted me. And when I decided to leave the community and come back to St. John's, I wanted to find a way to lead an intellectual life and to teach about the intellectual life that was open to that that ordinary human impulse, that ordinary human desire to understand and to examine fundamental questions. And so it was really that thinking and that experience, both of natural interest, then professional interest, then disillusionment, and then a kind of recovery through living a pretty ordinary life, that seemed to me the way to frame the way of the thinking that I present in the book. It's the origins in my life of, it's how I got to this particular set of ideas and images and ways of thinking about intellectual life.
Excellent. So can I ask a question about the book's title then? As I was finishing the book, remember the title is Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. And I'm not going to ask you about the pleasures part because there's a lot in the book about how to understand pleasure. I wanted just with the main title of the book. Even just now, as you were recounting the journey towards writing it, it seems like the book could have been titled Finding Oneself in Thought, or something like that. Your overall prescription has it that we've lost something in adopting a conception of learning that's overly instrumentalized. So can you tell us about the Lost in Thought title?
Sure. I begin the book with past my autobiography, past a philosophical introduction. It's a book with a long beginning. But the center of the book, I think, is a set of images of intellectual life from film, from history, from fiction. And one of those images is Socrates, who in the story told in Plato's Symposium, he's on his way to a dinner party, a very kind of high-end dinner party at Agathon, the hot new playwright's place. He gets all dressed up, very unusual for Socrates, just kind of a right. scrappy guy. And then
takes a bath.
He takes a bath for once. Yeah. And he travels, he takes a friend, and then he stops at the doorway and just falls into thinking, forgets where he is apparently, and stays there for some time. The guests notice that he hasn't come into the room. His poor friend who hasn't been invited has to go in by himself. So he's lost in thought at that moment. And that image is one of having an inner life. So Socrates at that moment is absorbed in something that's not his surroundings. It's not the fancy high-end party he's about to go to. It's not what speech is he about to give. It's something that's inward, And he's that inwardness is something withdrawn from the world in some sense. So it's a sign of detachment and absorption, and yet in the midst of activity, in the midst of excitement, in the midst of things that are really to ordinary people quite interesting. So that's where the title comes from, is from that scene of Socrates, and it's meant to echo throughout the book in other stories of human beings in different parts of history, different times and places, as I say, in fiction or in film, who I sometimes call it the hidden life of learning, the kind of learning that they live. Their learning is not about impressing people. It's not about making an impact. It's not about advancing themselves. It has no visible results. We have no idea, for instance, what was Socrates thinking about when he's sitting in the stairwell? No idea. Matter to him, I suppose, but we don't know what it was. So I try to spur my readers to reflect on how much real serious thinking goes on in hidden ways, in hidden places, and how precious that is, how important, and how it really illustrates something central about why learning matters.
Well, that's fabulous. I guess that a lot of the characters, and again, some of them are drawn from fiction novels, and others are drawn from films. I guess that part of part of your claim is that in these hidden moments, or in these hidden engagements or activities, that's where we sort of come to terms with ourselves or find ourselves. Is that right?
I think that's right. I can think of it in a couple of different ways, and I use different language in different contexts. One way of thinking about it is, it's hidden from external standards, external judgments. So it's one finds oneself because one tends to lose oneself, ironically enough, in what's outside, in what other people think, in what's expected. And sometimes our motivation to do that comes from us. So it's, we want to throw ourselves into various distractions, or we're workaholics. That's my particular disease. I'm a workaholic. I throw myself into work. Anything is better than facing whatever my particular inner emptiness is at the time. Or we also don't want to face the awkwardness and the difficulty and the humbleness of who we are in ourselves, by ourselves. So it is a way of finding oneself. And there are also some beautiful examples of that. My favorite, I suppose, at the moment is Malcolm X, who went to prison as a young man for theft. Had grown up in pretty extraordinarily difficult circumstances. His father was murdered by the KKK. His family's broken up by the welfare office. He's treated with great prejudice in school. So he gets to prison and meets another prisoner who seems to have something that he doesn't. That is, this guy has read a lot and thinks a lot and can hold forth on various topics. So Malcolm decides to read the whole prison library, more or less. He reads the great books. He reads about architecture. He reads about African history. He reads about the history of colonialism. And he becomes a different person by his own description. He becomes impassioned, disciplined, focused, and really dedicated to pursuing justice for the Black American community. And that he's a great example for me because he's an activist, if no one ever was. I mean, very much an active guy. But that activism was rooted in a long period of inwardness, of study and reflection. And I believe that that nourished him throughout his life. And it spurred him, for instance, to have a second conversion towards the end of his life, where he turned away from a particular strand of activism that he was involved in and moved towards another one. So I think it's a way of discovering oneself and also a way of maintaining oneself, of reminding oneself of who one is. So the inner life, on my view, is crucially important, both for its own sake, really, really for its own sake, just to be a human being, but also truthfully for anyone who wants to be active in the world or involved in the world.
Great, great. So to sort of segue into that, so the book is a kind of defense of the intrinsic value of learning, of learning for its own sake. Part of your account of this value has to do with, as you put it, the human need to escape from the world. And you present a few different modes of achieving what you call refuge, which turn out to be also ways of securing one's dignity. Can you tell us a little bit about those different ways of escaping from the world by means of learning?
I try to use the word refuge rather than the word escape for the following reason.
Good.
I try in the book, it's difficult to do, but I do try. I don't know if I succeed, but I try to make a distinction between an escape, which I would think would be a form of distraction, versus a refuge, which I think of as being a way of getting past what's superficial and into something which is deeper, more permanent, more rich, more powerful, more meaningful. The being in the world, I think, in either case is difficult. I don't think I need to tell your listeners why that might be true. There's all kinds of reasons why it's difficult, and there's all kinds of reasons why we might be driven either right to distraction, say, for instance, we're isolated in quarantine, or say that we're out of work, or say that we're at home homeschooling our kids while working full time, all using the same computer. I mean, whatever you want to say, we can't live in the here and now every second. So we either distract ourselves, we go to video games or social media or pornography or any other kind of Netflix or whatever other kind of thing is just gonna take our senses out of what's in front of us. And I'm not against all those things in principle, but I think that they're not ultimately fulfilling and satisfying. Whereas there are activities, I'd call them in a traditional sense leisure activities, in the sense that they're non-instrumental activities. They're things we do for their own sake, in which our life culminates in some way. Those activities are, for instance, creative activity, art, music, being in nature, being with one's family in a leisurely fashion where you're just enjoying one another. But key in, I think, that set of activities is studying and thinking and reflecting, either with books or without. So when we're thinking or studying or reflecting or contemplating, what we're doing matters all on its own. We're being human. We can think of this as being in some way what our life is about. We don't need anything further beyond it in the moment. And it's also a limitless source of growth. So we grow from our intellectual endeavors, however humble. And we grow in a way, I think, in a way that's more substantive, perhaps, even than those other leisure activities. So the intellectual life stretches us, it pushes us, and it changes us. And in ways that are rich and deep and wholesome, usually. And that's why I think it has this intrinsic value. It's because of that need to find one's dignity, find one's peace, find activities which are really worth doing in and of themselves. That's my thinking about why learning matters for its own sake.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Great. And so one way in which learning of that kind can be pursued is by being a bookworm. But there are others, right?
So one can be a bookworm. Oh, in terms of types of intellectual life, one can be a bookworm. One can be a amateur botanist. Look at the plants in your garden or in your surrounding area. Bird watcher. One could be a mathematician. That is, one can do math problems for the fun of it in one's head or on paper or what have you. One could just reflect and think about the people one knows. That's in fact one of my all-time favorite modes of reflection or thinking. Just to think about human beings, stories you've heard about them, people that you know, and try to get at what makes them tick. So people watchers also, they're great practitioners of this type of thinking. So there's a wide variety of ways that virtually everyone engages with in terms of thinking and reflection. It's something that academics do at a professional level in some way or other, but it's not limited to academics. And I think it's dangerous to think that it can be. It's basically in all kinds of places and can be found in all kinds of ways.
Right. And so you're early in the book, in the introduction, you're keen to point out that although learning for its own sake is a leisure activity, it's part of the way in which our understanding of learning has been corrupted or sullied in some way by the world of commerce, particularly, that we think that because it requires leisure that it's elitist. Is that right?
That's right. So one thought is, intellectual work, studying and thinking, that's for people who have, especially if you use the word leisure, which has a certain historical and economic set of baggage, political set of baggage with it. You know, it's the gentleman aristocrat farmer who, like Thomas Jefferson, who, you know, has slaves to do his labor, and then he sits back and, you know, translates Greek into Latin and back again, and, you know, builds clocks and whatever else, you know, dissects animals. So I think that leisure in the sense that matters, that I'm interested in, is perfectly compatible with being a working person. So you can work, you can have a family, you can be busy and still carve out leisure in which you can pursue these activities. You're studying and you're thinking and you're reflecting. And it's still going to be true that your life in some way can culminate in these moments. It can be a place where we put things together or where we take things apart or both. And it's, you know, the irony of my life is that I talk about leisure all the time, and I'm an extremely busy workaholic. But I do, I mean, it's my workaholic practice to talk about leisure and contemplation and the importance of slowing down. I do have always, for some reason, like to look at the sky in little transitional moments. So, you know, I leave my house, I get in the car, and I look up, and something in that moment is contemplative. It's reflective. It's a reminder of that I'm a part of something that's grander than myself, that there's something beyond this particular task I'm undertaking that's bigger than that. And even those little moments, I think, those little moments of contact can be ways of reminding oneself that one is a full human being with dignity and not just a sort of outcomes machine, which I think the way a lot of us feel.
Right, right. So as you see it, thought and learning are ways of sort of reconnecting with or discovering or affirming one's dignity. So you argue that the needed refuge is actually an internal operation. It's a turning within so that we can reflect on the ways in which we have gotten caught up with or internalized or accepted for ourselves a series of what might be characterized as sort of external or non-intrinsic drives and impulses from the world. And in this way, you see learning and taking up learning for its own sake as a kind of redemption. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of internalizing the drives and the priorities of the world?
Right. So it's one of the features of working with images that you can talk this way. So one might think that the inner world or a life that's withdrawn from the world, it has certain physical characteristics. That is, say there's a little corner of the house where you retreat to read your books, or a little study where you work, or one thinks about the cell of a monk or a nun. It's these little places that are withdrawn, literally withdrawn from the world. And I think those are good and useful, but the real work that intellectual life can help us with is having within oneself a refuge, and so transforming the way that we interact with and view the outside world. So if we go back to Malcolm X for a second, the world in which he goes to prison in the 1930s and the world in which he comes out in the 1940s, I might be getting the decades wrong, there might be 40s and 50s, but he still lives in a country which views African Americans very, in an extremely disparaging way. They're subject to violence, lynching. They are subject to prejudice. They live in segregation in the South. They're victims of police brutality, et cetera, et cetera. But whereas I think before his experience, his conversion, his transformation in prison, before that, he might have been inclined to view himself in light how others see him. That is, he might have been inclined to take those judgments seriously. And that's the danger of the world to one's dignity that I don't think I've made clear quite yet in this particular conversation. The danger is that one diminishes oneself, one sees one's value in terms that the terms that the world give you. And that can be bad if, of course, if you're at the bottom of the social barrel, if you're someone who is denied basic respect by the community. It's also true if you're successful. So if you're, you know, riding high on Wall Street and everyone thinks you're the greatest, you've also put your value in those circumstances, in your money, in the suits you're wearing, in your haircuts, in, you know, having the best looking boyfriend or girlfriend, driving the nicest car, et cetera. Those are not the things in which your dignity lies. So the social world contains within it all of these diminishing features that we need to recover our dignity from. And once we have found it, not that it's necessarily a once and for all sort of a thing. It may be hard work. It may take a long time. One may gain it and lose it. But that's something which can change the way that you view the judgments of society. It can give you a perspective from which those judgments are false or even meaningless. So that's, I think, an extremely valuable thing for a person to have, that is some perspective on their own value, which is not conditioned by what happens to them. I'll just say as an aside on that point that, you know, we talk a lot about learning for success, education for success, education for achievement, education for rising. And that's all well and good. There's nothing wrong with achievement. There's nothing wrong with rising. There's nothing wrong with success. But we also need to recognize the fact that what happens to us is not entirely under our control. That's obvious to people who live as victims of prejudice or social contempt of one kind or another. But it's true for all of us that we can achieve something, supposedly through education, and then lose it the next day on a dime. We need to have resources which we carry with us that are a part of who we are, so that we can be resilient and find our lives no matter where we are or what happens to us.
Good. So just to pick up on that, I take it that also part of the account is that the purposes and objectives and aims and ends that are ascribed from sources outside of ourselves that are then that we're then incentivized to internalize and make our own. I take it that your account isn't simply that there's something lamentable about having one's sense of oneself sort of be entirely the product of some external sources, but also that there's a kind of emptiness to those ascriptions, that the drives and the values and the purposes that are imposed and that we are encouraged to internalize have a character that renders a life spent in pursuing or realizing those goals vapid, right?
Right. So, you know, I think I want to put it this way. As you might have been able to tell already, or even just from reading the book, I tend to shift the way I talk about things to try to get another angle of them. And that means sometimes I risk inconsistency, but at least I hope people who are listening or reading think about what's going on. So here's the thing. So think about the pursuit of power and status. So set money aside for the time being, which might be a means to either of those things. So my thought is that if you define your life by your success on those terms, how much status have you gotten? How much power have you gotten? Your life will be empty, and it will be empty because those things that you're seeking are capricious on the one hand. They depend on others. They tend to be given or taken away in a way that's a bit arbitrary. So, you know, you can be top of the heap today and bottom of the heap tomorrow. And it's not because of the merits of you or your work, but just because that's the way things go. And there's something in us, I think, that is not satisfied by something which is that contingent, that dependent on others, and that really thin. It's a thin thing, the approval of others and status and power. Now, so the difficulty is living by those things. Now, it's not as if everyone has to take relatively privileged people like ourselves who have some power and some status. It's not as if everyone has to sacrifice all of that and go and live lives of poverty or wander the Russian steppes like pilgrims, as the ancient Orthodox pilgrims used to do, or maybe still do. I hope they do. I think that that's good. I mean, I think there are lives of renunciation that are beautiful, that bear witness to the kinds of truths I'm talking about, that certain people are called to do. But the point is, ultimately, power and status are tools. They are means to an end. They are not ways of organizing one's life. So take, for instance, I'm now an author. it's a new feeling for me. It's only about the past 6 months. I suddenly have a different status in the world and people treat me differently. Now, I enjoy that. I've always been an ambitious person who liked people's approval, like most of us. But it's also useful because I have this cause I've devoted myself to, namely the promotion of a certain kind of learning. So I can use this status I have to promote something that I care about, that matters, that helps others, that serves the community in some way. So there's nothing wrong with doing that. And then if I lose the status for whatever reason, I can still do that work in whatever way it befits my circumstances. But the point is to really to have the goods of one's life in the right order, where the things which really are just means to an end, money, status, power, they're just means. They're only valuable because of how they're used. Those need to be kept in the right perspective and not pursued simply for their own sake. Here's another example. Twitter, okay, or other social media platforms, they're great as tools. So I have connected with a number of people who are also interested in liberal learning and learning for its own sake, both students and fellow teachers. And that's been great. You can learn about things that you wanted to know about. You can connect with like-minded people. But of course, we also know it can take on the aspect of something we pursue for its own sake. So we can spend hours upon hours just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. Is there something interesting here? Is there something interesting here? And we all know, everyone who's done that, which is most of us, I think, we all know that that makes you feel dead inside and empty because you're using something which is really just a means to something else as if it were something that could satisfy you. And so it's trying to keep the right order and to keep parts of life that matter most at the fore.
Right. Could you, in this connection, I found the discussion about the virtue of seriousness really compelling. Can you tell us a little bit about what you call the virtue of seriousness, which I take it is meant to convey that the life of the flourishing life of the human mind has to be motivated or fixed on something other than entertainment?
So I think that. Sorry, did you have another sentence?
No. I was going to ask you about about the Greek word spoudaios, but Aristotle sometimes talks about people being serious, I'm just curious. Can you elaborate a little bit on the virtue?
Sure. So I actually was not thinking about spoudaios when I wrote about seriousness. I was thinking about the Latin word that's in Augustine that's mm-hmm. contrasted with curiosus or curiositas, mm-hmm. which I call the love of spectacles in the book.
Right.
It's seeking out stimulation or entertainment for its own sake without regard to its contents. So it's the word studiosus, which gets later turned into the virtue studiositas. And I didn't like studiousness, the literal right. translation, because that sounds boring and like someone who's a rule follower, you know, so someone who's studious, they do all their homework, you know, and I didn't think that was quite right. So I was using the virtue of seriousness to explain, there's really two different phenomena I'm trying to explain, which is makes it a bit complicated. One phenomenon I'm trying to explain is the reason why a certain type of person, and the example in the book is Dorothy Day, she read a lot, and she took the books very seriously. That is, she read for the sake of life, of living, of learning how to live, rather than as a source of distraction or entertainment. The books she read, some of them were really good, and some of them weren't that great. Okay, so Upton Sinclair, The Jungle, it's not that great. It's interesting, it's gripping, it's sure. historically important, but it's a bit lurid, sensationalist, and so on. But because she was a serious person, because she was driven to live in a way that was more deep, more profound, more in touch with reality. She wanted to love more, to know more. So she had this drive within her that meant that whatever she read, she would chew it up and turn it into something else. So that was one phenomenon I was trying to explain why it might not depend, living a life of learning might not depend on reading the most high-end materials or absorbing the most high-end content, so long as one was really determined to make one's life out of what one encountered and really take what was good in it. So that was one thing I was trying to explain. The other thing I was trying to explain was this comes from back in Augustine. Curiositas, or the love of spectacle, it's this part of us which wants to just engage the surface of things. So we just want to, the best example I think for us is, you know, you drive past a car accident and you just want to look. Why do you want to look? You're not going to learn anything. You know what car accidents are. You know what they do to people. And it doesn't matter how many times you look or how many car accidents you see, you're still going to want to keep looking. And there's a way in which you just want that shock of experience to shake your senses. Watching gladiator matches, that's Augustine's example, or right. watching spiders kill flies, or social media, I think, is a prime example. You know, people love bad news. It's so weird. The most outrageous, horrible thing will be what everyone just eats up. And
we even have a term for it, right? Doom scrolling.
Doom scrolling, exactly. And you don't want to read. You don't want to read the little correction that comes out the next day that tells you that in fact it was much more nuanced than that, and not quite as bad as you thought it was. You're not interested in that. You want that feeling of outrage, that feeling of horror. So, I wanted to explain what the good version of that was. That's what's the way of using our senses, using what we read or experience for our own good. I thought that seriousness might be a way of thinking about that would be helpful. That is, we can, you can even, the same activity can become serious if one has that in one's heart. So one can scroll through Twitter praying fervently for every lost soul that one comes across. That would be a serious approach to Twitter. It would be difficult, but it would be serious. Or likewise, you know, one could take a serious interest in even the car accidents on the road or in gladiator matches. Or in lurid, maybe a good example would be, you know, reading slave narratives, which are often full of lurid descriptions, but which also reveal a sort of horror that in our history that we hide from, mm-hmm. and that we don't much want to think about, and which shows us something about what's in an American heart, what's in a human heart, what's in the hearts of the people that we know. So. It's I think it might not be a very refined tool, but it's a tool for trying to understand what good functioning in the realm of the intellect looks like.
Great. So you've been very generous with your time. I want to make sure that we get to talk about the third chapter, where there's a lot goes on in the third chapter. So the third chapter explores the ways in which learning can be corrupted, not by money and not by status, but by politics, or it can be corrupted by the need for thought to be applicable in current struggles for things like justice. Now, there's a lot to say, can you walk us through your thoughts there?
Sure. My thinking on this has developed in a certain way. So the main thing I was concerned about, and I still am concerned about, is that the love of justice, the search for justice, can corrupt learning in a certain way. Now, that's not because the love of justice or the search for justice isn't important. It's crucially important. But it is something different than learning for its own sake. So it can have the effect, if one mixes them up in the wrong way, of turning learning as something driven by an agenda. So that is, there's some political conclusion, there's some political outcome that's turning the wheels on the thinking machinery. And that's an important type of thinking to do if you're an advocate, if you're working in politics, if you're an activist, or if you're what have you. But it's a very bad way to learn, because learning as such needs to be open-ended. It needs to have its conclusions be held lightly, and it needs to kind of follow its own logic. That's why I think authentic learning, learning for its own sake, is often a bit painful, because it often happens that we come up against some reality that conflicts with an agenda. It could be a political agenda, could be a personal agenda, could be just something you thought you were right about. So something in your vanity. But you have to be willing to let those things go. And if your learning is too agenda driven, and this happens incidentally on the right as well as on the left, this is not a partisan point. Then you're not really thinking openly and clearly. So that's the one thing I want to say. The second thing, which is more a recent development, which I think doesn't turn up in the book as much as I would like it to now, I do think that there's a type of freedom, individual freedom, that's cultivated by learning for its own sake. It's a way of thinking for oneself. Thinking independently, thinking reflectively about whatever kinds of information or ideas or thoughts that you're receiving from the outside world. And it's very important politically that this type of learning be kept alive, not for any partisan purpose, but for egalitarianism, for a kind of political community that's based on accountability and some kind of democratic control, some kind of rule of law. What you need citizens who know how to make their own judgments and are in trust and trust themselves and trust one another to come to conclusions. So that's something which it's a bit more hackneyed, which may be just as well why I didn't find it in the book. But I have come to think as time has gone on that it's an argument that it's worth remembering. That is, partisan politics, I think, needs to be kept separate from thinking. But thinking really is crucial for the flourishing of our communities, politically speaking and otherwise.
Well, that seems right. And are you concerned about the ways in which politics has been, I don't want to even say introduced, because that's not the right way to characterize it, but the ways in which particularly perhaps in college teaching, it's become more common to think that thinking is and learning are intrinsically political in a way that aligns them with partisan objectives and ideals?
Well, I think that I want to make a distinction, which may be hard to make in practice, but I think it can be made in principle. There's quite a lot of interesting thinking, interesting in and of itself, about how thinking is political. And it's at least as old as Rousseau, and it extends into the 19th and 20th century. It's a pretty wide stream of European thinking about what thinking is and how it works. It works politically. And I don't want to say thinking along these lines doesn't belong in the university. Of course it does. Where else would it belong? It's important to reflect on these questions. I think the kind of thing I'm concerned about, honestly, is that it's the kind of political thinking about academia. It happens in the classroom. It happens outside the classroom. That stems from an anxiety about the worth of what we're doing. So there's a mistrust of academic work. There's a mistrust of teaching. There's a thought that, say, puzzling through some argument or memorizing an old poem is somehow not really useful. And in a world so riven with injustice, we have got to use every minute and every time and every fiber of our being to make a difference, to promote outcomes. It's that kind of thing that I'm much more concerned about. It's not a particular mode of thinking that I think doesn't belong in universities, doesn't belong in the classroom, as far as, does thinking depend on your political circumstances? It's more that's almost a spiritual problem where people don't think that just thinking is worth doing, and they don't believe that it will have, they don't trust their students, or they don't trust themselves to teach things in an open-ended way because they're fearful that the outcomes won't be quite what they want them to be. And I think that's quite dangerous for just the thing I'm talking about, is the cultivation of real egalitarianism, where we as a community of somewhat equal citizens get together and make decisions for ourselves. You can't do that if you're digesting all of your teaching for people who you think can't make decisions for themselves and need to be told exactly how to interpret it. So it's much more the latter that I'm worried about. Yeah, than the former.
Right. So would this be fair? The concern is with a kind of making political of learning that makes learning a mode of commerce. It's just now that the currency is politics.
Something, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's helpful. Yeah, what's this going to do for me or for you? Well, it's going to bring more activists on the street for this cause. It's going to bring more votes for this question. It's going to pour more research into this cause that I think wants to be researched. It's, you're not just sitting back and letting the ideas take you wherever they're going to take you. That end, I do think the question of how our political situation, our social situation influences our thinking, and whether there is such a thing as thinking which is independent of our political context or our circumstances, I think that has to be that's a big question. It's a question. It's not a conclusion, and we need to keep revisiting it. and keep examining it, even if it's true, because we need to take it in for ourselves and see what nuances might be there that we might not have seen before.
Well, that's a good note to end on, with an election coming up. Zena, it's been really great to talk to you. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks so much. It's been great to talk to you, Bob.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion of Zena Hitz's new book, which is published by Princeton University Press. Zena's book is titled Lost in Thought: The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.